ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Friday, the 3rd of May. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Today, senior police ministers and commissioners come together in Canberra over the rates of violence against women. Can more be done by police to address the problem? And from cab-sav to cannabis, growers in South Australia's wine region turn to medicinal marijuana, hoping to cash in on the emerging industry.
I think there's a, you know, huge potential for us around Australia, and because we're able to provide jobs, I really think we do need to see the government get a little bit more behind the Australian industry.
Three people have been arrested after the disappearance of Australian brothers Jake and Callum Robinson in Mexico. The Perth men were on a surfing trip in the state of Baja, California, in Mexico's northwest. Their burnt-out ute has been found on a farm in the region. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says the situation is concerning and the Australian Embassy is working with local police. Alison Shaw reports.
The west coast of Mexico is one of the most popular surfing spots in the world. It's where West Australians Jake and Callum Robinson were surfing when they disappeared over the weekend.
We certainly hope that these brothers are found safely, but there is real concern about the fact that they've gone missing.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese spoke to Sunrise about the search for the Perth brothers.
Their mother is obviously very distressed about this, and we just hope for a positive outcome.
A 23-year-old woman was arrested yesterday in connection with the disappearance. Police have now arrested another two men who are brothers. Detectives found a burnt-out car belonging to the Australians on a ranch and say the three people arrested were found with drugs when they were detained. Baja California's Chief Prosecutor Maria Elena Andrade Ramirez says police are combing through evidence.
A working team of investigators is at the site where they were last seen, where tents and other evidence were found that could be linked to these three people we have under investigation.
Oliver Quintero is a local Mexican reporter who's been following the story. He says a mobile phone allegedly found by police is forming a major part of their investigation, as it's believed to belong to one of the missing men.
That is actually how they were found. The police were able to track the GPS on one of the phones, and that's how they got the lady. He was the one that had the phone and was with the other two gentlemen. And we also heard that they were carrying a large amount of drugs. So it's now being also a drug investigation regarding the arrested people.
Jake and Callum had been travelling through Baja, California with an American friend who is also missing. It's understood the trio had been camping at popular surfing spot Punta San Jose near Ensenada. Oliver Quintero says the burnt-out car and tents were found in a remote area.
Where they were found, their belongings, it's not actually in the city of Ensenada, but it's around 90 minutes, and it's a remote area of Ensenada. It's kind of popular with some surfers that like virgin beaches and stuff like that, but it's definitely a secluded area. So, unfortunately, if something happens there, there's not a lot of people that can help you.
The case has caused concern among many in the surfing community back in Australia. Sean McDevitt is the president of the Peninsula Surf Riders Club on the Mornington Peninsula.
Mexico is amazing for surfing because it's still somewhat of a wild frontier. It's still raw. You can travel to super remote locations, find some of the world's best surfing, right up there with like Indonesia, Australia and Hawaii. And not have the people around you and sort of feel like you've thrown yourself back in time a little bit. And I think that's the adventure a lot of us go looking for.
He spent 7 months travelling around Baja and mainland Mexico.
It's definitely not the safest place to travel. When you're off the beaten track, you definitely feel isolated because Mexico is quite a large country and everyone's sort of aware of the drug cartel problems over there. So it's always in the back of your mind. But you know what it's like when you're a young person travelling, you're sort of just having a good time and just winging it, really.
He says it's a tragic story and he's hoping for a positive outcome.
I feel so badly for the family. I know if it was me and my parents were worrying about me back in Australia, it would just be the worst thing ever. So, yeah, I feel terribly for them.
The Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade says it's providing consular assistance to the family, and due to privacy obligations, they're unable to provide further comment.
Alison Shao. State and Territory Police Ministers and Commissioners are meeting today in Canberra to discuss the rates of violence against women across the country. They'll consider how to improve police responses to high-risk and serial perpetrators, including the use of focused deterrence and fixated threat strategies. Associate Professor Terry Goldsworthy is a criminologist at Bond University. As a starting point, he says he'd like to see a streamlining of the paperwork involved in processing cases of domestic violence.
It is problematic. If you've got, 40% of police time being taken up with domestic violence-related duties, you run into that risk of that police don't want to be tied up for half the shift, so they will categorise events as non-DV so they don't lose that 3.5 hours and they can move on to other policing issues. So I think, one of the priorities I would have liked to have seen come out of the inquiry had up here, but it didn't seem to, was a vested interest in reducing the amount of time it takes for police to process these matters.
What's it like to be called to someone's home with reports of domestic disturbances?
Well, look, for me it was problematic in the first instance because I was a young 19, 20-year-old going in and speaking to people who were in their 50s who were having relationship issues, domestic violence issues, and they tend to not listen to your world experience too much because you don't have that much. But certainly it's problematic. You sometimes see police go, oh, we're not relationship counsellors. Well, that's true, they're not. But they do have to go in and make sure that, relationship issues, which may be problematic, don't then turn into criminal issues that will be even more serious later down the track. So, it's a difficult area to police for them. Police often only see domestic violence as a policing issue when it reaches that peak criminal issue, and that being a domestic violence homicide. Prior to that, they don't see it necessarily as a policing issue, but more of an administrative process.
You've talked about young police officers turning up on the site of a domestic violence disturbance. Might there be a specialised unit that takes the call out that perhaps has more training in those areas?
Oh, look, certainly. I have been making calls for that for some time. We had a domestic violence command put in place in Queensland a couple of years ago, and it was a command in name only. There was actually no staff attached to it, and that became evident during the inquiry that we had up here a couple of years ago. And, I draw the analogy, if you look at how we react to outlaw motorcycle gangs and their crime and how we react to domestic violence crime. So, I had a look at the data, and over a five-year period between 2016 and 2021, bikie crime accounted for 0.34% of all Queensland reported crime, 0.34. Domestic violence crime, and this isn't all of it, but this is DVA breaches, order breaches and DV-related crime, accounted for 6% of our overall crime. So, you've got to ask the question, when we have a small group of bikies misbehaving, we put 200 police dedicated into fighting that and dealing with it. I would have thought that we would be putting dedicated policing units in every police district to deal specifically with domestic violence matters. We have had some task forces put in place, but my understanding from those task forces is that they don't actually do the investigations. They're just really an information clearinghouse. And the investigations still go back out to, depending on the severity, to first year uniform officers, first year constables, for instance. But I would have thought, we would now be moving to a model, given the impact on time and resources this crime category has, to dedicated task forces in every district to deal with these issues. We do it for youth crime, we do it for child sexual abuse, etc. I don't know why we don't do it for domestic violence crime.
Terry Goldsworthy, thanks very much for joining The World Today.
Thanks, Rachel.
That's criminologist and former police officer Terry Goldsworthy. And if you're in an abusive situation or know someone who is, call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, call 000. This is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Australians are being warned to prepare for the housing affordability crisis to deepen as supply fails to keep up with demand. Analysts say this means steeper rental increases and bigger deposits for first home buyers and those looking to buy property. It follows an independent report indicating the government won't meet its dwelling supply targets unless it fulfills all of its housing promises. Here's reporter David Taylor.
Rick Graff is a development director with Bilbergia, which builds housing and the community infrastructure around it. He says there's nowhere near enough housing in Australia to meet demand.
We've never been worse in our position of supply versus demand.
It's also hit home, quite literally, for the property developer.
You know, my kids have had to move out of Sydney up to the Blue Mountains or anywhere else in the hope of getting housing, and that's with two incomes and good jobs.
Experts agree more housing supply is needed to make buying and renting property more affordable. AMP Deputy Chief Economist Diana Musina.
We're building about 165,000 to 170,000 new homes a year, but based on our current levels of demand, which is ultimately driven by our population growth, we should be building about 240,000 to 250,000 homes a year, and that would be more in line with the government's housing accord policy. So we are well off those numbers.
The government set up a target of 1.2 million homes over 5 years to help meet ever-growing demand. It's also put in place practical policies to help achieve this goal, including the $10 billion Housing Australia Future Fund. But an independent report from the National Housing Supply and Affordability Council forecasts Australia will miss this target unless the government fulfills all of its housing promises. As a result, Council Chair Susan Lloyd-Hurwitz warns of worsening conditions across the housing system for years to come.
So currently we're looking at a shortfall of new demand, so new households forming versus new supply, of a shortfall of 40,000 over that period. Of course, that does not go to redress the undersupply that's already in the system.
Economist Diana Musina says this means renters and first home buyers are going to need to dig even further into their pockets to afford housing.
Rental prices are still likely to remain quite high. In the March quarter, rental prices increased by over 2% over the quarter. Over the past year, rents are running at about 8% year on year. So that's very high. And I think that that pace of growth is probably likely to continue in 2024, just based on these levels of housing undersupply that we have at the moment.
And property prices too? Are you expecting 5% growth in the national average property price this year, or perhaps even more than that?
Yeah, our base case is for 5% growth in prices, and the risk is to the upside.
So what, if anything, on top of what's being done, can be achieved to make housing more affordable? Well, Treasurer Jim Chalmers says the government has already committed more than $25 billion to new housing initiatives in the upcoming budget. But property developer Rick Graff, who's provided testimony for a number of Senate committees on housing in Canberra, says the focus for now should be squarely on how to speed up the planning process at the state level.
We still have, in New South Wales, the slowest planning system in the nation, one of the slowest in the world, and incrementally playing with business as usual isn't going to bring us the dramatic change in housing supply that we actually need.
Property developer Rick Graff ending David Taylor's report. Bill Shorten has rebuked the OECD for warning that the ballooning costs of the National Disability Scheme need to be reined in. The NDIS minister scoffed at what he's called self-appointed foreign experts who need to be looking at improving disability services elsewhere in the world. I spoke earlier with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, firstly, what has the OECD suggested and why has it angered Bill Shorten?
Well, Rachel, the ballooning cost of the NDIS is an ongoing headache for the federal government, and the attacks on its sustainability are unrelenting, especially with the federal budget just around the corner. But the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, known as the OECD, has singled out the NDIS in its global outlook, urging, quote, tangible measures to slow growth in costs for the scheme, and it also wants to see better clarity on the eligibility and scope of support packages, as well as improved administration of the scheme, warning that Australia has other big fiscal challenges such as the climate transition to renewables and also the ageing population. Speaking in Melbourne, Bill Shorten told me the NDIS will be reformed, but the OECD's advice clearly hit a nerve.
Labor's committed to the NDIS. It's here to stay. We think it is probably growing too quickly, but we still want it to grow. I respect the OECD, but maybe some of these OECD, you know, economists need to come and visit families whose lives are being changed by the NDIS. But I do get frustrated sometimes when self-appointed foreign experts want to talk about whether or not a child with Down syndrome should be getting the package of support they're getting. How about the OECD studies every other country who doesn't have an NDIS? Why doesn't the OECD start demanding a better deal for disabled people in the rest of the world than just focusing on the deal we get in this country?
That's the Minister for the NDIS, Bill Shorten. And Peter, we heard him there saying that foreign experts were weighing in there, but the OECD was sticking to its knitting, so to speak, when it warned about the global economy and Australia's economy, especially as we're leading up to the federal budget.
Well, that's right, Rachel, and the big message here is that official interest rates in Australia and around the world will probably stay higher for longer, and that the federal government needs to rein in spending elsewhere to help tame inflation. The OECD thinks the global economy remains resilient despite what's still quite high inflation, which is now getting lower, sees Australian growth slowing to 1.5% this year before picking up to 2.3% next year as cost of living pressures through falling inflation wane. Unemployment expected to rise to 4.3% next year. Now, normally that might mean inflation will ease and interest rates will come down, but Matthias Cormann, the former Australian Finance Minister, who's now the OECD's Secretary General, is pretty cautious and sombre and says that Australia needs to show restraint if they're serious about taming inflation. And Rachel, most economists now don't see any interest rate cuts until early 2025.
Peter Ryan. As police in the US crack down on pro-Palestinian protests on college campuses, university leaders in Australia say they want to ensure demonstrations happening here remain peaceful and respectful. Institutions and political leaders are trying to walk a tightrope by allowing free speech while preventing hate speech and violence. Gavin Coote reports.
From Los Angeles to New York, police are dismantling pro-Palestinian encampments on US college campuses and arresting hundreds of student protesters. Israel's ongoing war in Gaza, which was triggered by the October 7 attack on southern Israel by Hamas, has unleashed a massive outpouring of student activism. And despite the police crackdown, many students aren't backing down.
Young people will not budge on this issue.
Sanjay Murali-Theran is the national vice president of the College Democrats, which has more than 100,000 members and is supporting peaceful protests. The organisation supports the re-election of Joe Biden in the upcoming presidential election, but is sharply critical of his ongoing support for Israel.
And if he hopes to have young people turn out in waves in 2024, come November, he's going to have to do a lot better than he's been doing right now.
Similar pro-Palestinian encampments have been set up across some universities in Australia over the last week, but they've remained mostly peaceful. At the University of Melbourne yesterday, there was a confrontation between pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian campaigners. Professor Stephen Prower is from the Australian Academic Alliance Against Anti-Semitism. He wants a more respectful approach from both sides of the debate.
I mean, Jewish students are genuinely worried about being accosted and attacked. And this has happened both in the classroom and on the campus. And it's eating away at our social cohesion on the campus. It's supposed to be a place for respectful disagreements.
And at the University of Sydney, where pro-Palestinian protesters have been camped out for more than a week, some staff there are also concerned about how the demonstrations are playing out. Catherine Lumby is a professor of media at the university.
And I'm concerned that there's been a shutting down of debate. And I am also concerned for my Jewish colleagues and students, some of whom have been very clear that they don't feel safe. Now, it doesn't mean the university is not doing its job. I think that our vice chancellor is in a very difficult position because on one hand, he wants to allow free speech. On the other hand, he wants to make sure that everyone feels safe on campus. So it's a very difficult balancing act at the moment.
University of Sydney's Vice Chancellor Mark Scott estimates that fewer than half of the protesters are actually from the university.
So I cannot vouch for the behaviour of all of those people. We are making it very clear, though, what our expectations are about language that is violent, statements that are anti-Semitic, statements that are threatening and menacing. They are outside our code of conduct. And if our students and staff engage in that, we are taking action around that.
Mark Scott says the focus is on de-escalation.
I think if you look at what has happened in the United States, universities have taken action, and the day after that, it's more violent, it's less safe, universities are being shut down. I think we're trying to manage this in a way that keeps the university safe, keeps the university open.
University of Sydney's Vice Chancellor Mark Scott, ending that report by Gavin Koosh. In South Australia's Riverland, citrus orchards have been pulled out to plant one of the country's biggest outdoor cannabis crops. With Australia's largest wine-producing region in crisis, growers are abandoning family tradition for in-demand crops like medicinal cannabis. The ABC was given exclusive access to see the sun-grown crop during its first harvest. Eliza Bellage reports.
Dozens of Pacific Island workers cut leaves under the warm sun as they harvest medicinal cannabis. It's the first crop collected at MedTech Farmers' secure facility in the Riverland. And while it's taken grower Brad Gallard 5 years to get to this point, he's yet to make a cent.
Even though the plant does grow fast, it's been a long journey to get to this point.
The third generation citrus farmer is convinced medicinal cannabis will pay off.
The latitude of 34 degrees is really what cannabis does like. There's obviously certain strains that can do colder climates or more humid climates, but they do say where citrus grows, cannabis grows really well too.
For Brad Gallard, the decision to push ahead with a new crop is also a personal one.
My father has Parkinson's disease, my mum had scleroderma and ulcers, and tried a bit of the product just after it was sort of legal and saw a reasonable result for at least a few days, so I thought I'd better look into it.
With the wine industry in crisis due to an oversupply, opportunities to diversify are becoming vital for areas like this. The operation here has now employed 30 staff. Serena Lange was snapped up before she'd graduated from her agribusiness degree.
And was it ever a job you thought about doing growing up?
Absolutely not, but it's incredibly exciting to move forward in this industry. There's so much learning to be done.
The company is not only growing cannabis outdoors, it also has indoor rooms and plans to build a lab to develop new strains to grow from seed to shelf. Derek Fitzner is the site manager, and while he's also new to cannabis cultivation, he's warming to it quickly.
These plants are so green and bright and leafy. What's the thermostat read like?
At the moment as we stand here, it's a perfect 24 degrees at about 80% humidity.
The majority of the plants grown here have what's known as THC cannabinoids, the psychoactive compound, which can be smoked or eaten. The compound called CBD is more commonly used for oils and tinctures, but does not create a high feeling for users.
They are both relevant to the medicinal space.
Australia has one of the fastest growing medicinal cannabis markets in the world, but only about 50 licensed growers. Research scientist and industry advocate Emily Rigby launched the Australian Cannabis Cultivators Group last year to help producers grow the domestic supply.
I think there's a huge potential for us around Australia, and because we're able to provide jobs, I really think we do need to see the government get a little bit more behind the Australian industry to help this emerging industry.
Now, with all of his licences in place, Brad Gallard's next step will be to develop the crop from 3 to 10 hectares for next year's harvest.
Yeah, the Australian growing pretty much gets sold out every year. So, we're really going about that sustainability as well on top of a high quality medicinal product.
MedTech Pharma Managing Director Brad Gallard, ending that report from Eliza Berlage. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The pro-Palestinian movement at unis across the US that's seen more than 1,000 students arrested has landed here. Today we look at the encampments popping up on campuses across the country and ask how will uni leaders allow freedom of speech while ensuring Jewish students and staff feel safe. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.